This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ricky Gervais became famous worldwide for starring in and co-creating a British TV series that only a few million Americans have seen, the original version of The Office, which was first shown in England on the BBC. The American version, starring Steve Carell on NBC, is one of the 8 international versions of The Office, with more on the way. After The Office, Gervais went on to create Extras with his writing partner Stephen Merchant, and he co-wrote and stars in the film The Invention of Lying, which just came out on DVD. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke with Ricky Gervais last week. They began by talking about his latest project, an animated HBO series, The Ricky Gervais Show, which airs Fridays. It features the freewheeling conversations which he recorded with Stephen Merchant and a radio producer, Carl Pilkington, who's the real star of the show. These were initially produced as podcasts which made it into the 2007 Guinness Book of World Records as the most downloaded podcast on the Internet. What did they talk about? Here's an example. Stephen Merchant is posing this hypothetical question to Carl Pilkington. If you could choose any superpower, what would it be?
Remember, you've already got opposable thumbs. So that, cross that one off the list.
Oh, go on, Carl.
There are so many to choose from. Telepathy, X-ray vision.
Flight. Invisibility.
Choose it wisely.
Strength.
Intelligence.
But why have I been picked?
Oh, for God's sake!
No, but I'm just saying...
It's Rob's question for you.
But I'd just say, does anyone else want this?
Ricky Gervais, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
I love that he's immediately questioning the premise.
Yeah, of course. He's quite cautious, and he asks questions that you never dreamt he would ever ask or need to ask. He hasn't got a pretentious bone in his body. I think it's impossible for him. The concept of pretension does not exist in his world. So everything you get is unfiltered and honest. He downloads his brain for your pleasure. I mean, I think what he comes down to eventually when pressured is invisibility. And we ask him what he'd do with this, and he decides that he'd go into a shop and, be invisible, wait for the shop to shut, and then he would shop at his leisure, buy some records, pay for them, and leave. That's what he would use his superpower for. I mean, we were doing one audiobook, I think it was the Ricky Gervais Guide to Philosophy, and I posed him the Robert Nozick scenario, where if you could script your life, perfectly pre-programmed your life, you could get into a float tank and you'd live a virtual life, a perfect life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would you choose that or reality with all the pain and suffering? But it's real, and I think most people would probably choose a real life. Carl pondered this, and his virtual life, his perfect existence, turned out to be exactly the life he's got now, but his boiler would work. And again, I don't think he was making the most of the opportunity.
Well, you know, I always look at it thinking, is he putting you on? Is he putting me on? And then I finally decided, tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, that Carl Pilkington is to you and Stephen Merchant what Margaret Dumont was for the Marx Brothers. I mean, someone who has no clue how funny you are, much less how funny they are.
Yeah. I mean, Carl, I don't know what Carl laughs at in his own life, what he finds amusing. He's quite a serious... You'd think he was a tortured, troubled soul, but he's not. He's just quite happy doing the stuff he does. The only time he's not happy is when he can't get to do the same stuff he does every day. He likes pottering around. He likes doing nothing. He likes sitting in tea shops, eating cake with his girlfriend. He's totally happy with that. He actually said he's looking forward to being old. He said old people are no trouble. I don't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
They're no trouble. Like you can wrangle them easy or they don't get into fights. I don't know. But he says he's looking forward to being old because then you can just sit out in the street in a chair and no one gives you dirty looks like you're lazy. I mean, that's an ambition. That's a hell of an ambition, isn't it?
I have one last question about the Ricky Gervais show, and that's the animation style. I know that there were fans who were sort of doing animated versions of some of the podcasts, and then you come out with a TV show version of it, which is brilliant recycling, if nothing else. I'm wondering, yep. Is the animation style, is it based more on Flintstones, Hanna-Barbera, or Rocky and Bullwinkle?
Certainly, that was the remit. I did a sketch of myself initially for the animation house, and I wanted it to be a cross between Hanna-Barbera and 1950s children's comics of Britain, like the Beano and the Dandy. And there was a very good reason for that. I wanted it to be warm and approachable and not spiky and trendy and innovative in that sense. Because for two reasons, I wanted people to know that this is quite a nice, cuddly show. Because on the face of it, it's quite challenging. We're talking about, you know, there are no taboo subjects. We talk about race, disability. And I wanted people to know it was, like, safe and sweet. And Carl is quite childlike. Anything he says is not malicious. He doesn't wish harm on anyone. I mean, he's fascinated by difference. But I think in the best way, in the same way that a child is. A child stares because he hasn't seen it before. There's no malice. It's the parents that are embarrassed when they say, don't look. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are embarrassed socially. A child's just looking at stuff. And Carl's like that. Carl is like that. Carl is asking genuine questions without prejudice. The fact that he comes out with horrendous statements, I have to explain to people that he's an idiot. He thought that Anne
Frank...
How
nice of you to explain that.
Well, of course, I have to. It's my job. but he thought that Anne Frank was just avoiding paying rent. We had to explain to him that she was hiding from the Nazis because he has no formal education. He doesn't, you know, it's like people take things for granted because we've been learning all our life and from an early age, and now we think everyone knows these things, but Carl doesn't. Carl doesn't know these things. Throughout the podcast, throughout the 5 or 6 years, there's things that seem so obvious to us that are revelations to him. And I think that people should know that they're going to see over this, you know, these however many seasons we do, we're going to see Carl get slightly more educated. I mean, even arrogant in his stupidity sometimes, where he gets more confident, which is my favourite, like, you know, a la Homer Simpson. There was one point I was trying to explain evolution to him.
Oh, yes.
And he went, yeah, yeah. He said, I've got the gist of it. I go, go on. He went, I know it went germ, fish, mermaid, man. Mermaid. Unbelievable.
We're speaking with Ricky Gervais, co-star and co-creator of BBC's The Office and of the HBO series Extras and the new Ricky Gervais Show, which premiered last month and airs Fridays on HBO. Here in the States, The Office was shown on BBC America and seen by a couple of million people. So most people haven't seen you in America for the role for which you are so internationally famous. They know the NBC version, but they haven't seen you as David Brent. And I thought that I'd start off this section by playing a clip from The Office.
There's good news and bad news. The bad news is Neil will be taking over both branches, and some of you will lose your jobs. Yeah. Those of you who are kept on will have to relocate to Swindon if you want to. So, yeah. Stay. I know. Gutting. You didn't see me. On a more positive note, the good news is I've been promoted. So, every cloud. You're still thinking about the bad news, aren't you?
I do think that's one of the most pitch-perfect characters and comedies ever done for television. And
thank you very much.
It seemed fully formed at the beginning. And I'm wondering if you really had that sort of confidence going in both the character and the presentation from the very start.
Yeah, I was confident in the character. It didn't feel like an acting job. It felt like I was doing an impression of someone I'd never met before, which I suppose is what acting is, really. But I was much more worried about the realism of the piece. I wanted to keep in all the fluffs, all the mouth touching, all the things that rustled the microphone. Directorially, the realism, the motivation for the players. I always hated exposition. You know, when people would come in and say, "John, you know your sister, the one who went to the Gambia?"
Mm-hmm.
"Yes, of course I do. She's my sister. Why are you..." You know, you might as well look at the camera. And so we tried to avoid that, and we tried to make everything organic. We didn't want people entering, doing a scene, and then leaving in opposite directions. So we had to find them. And I think that's what people connected with initially, was the realism of the piece, and saying, I know someone like that. And we peppered them with the annoyance of mundane life. You know, some people say that drama is real life with the boring bits taken out. Well, we left them in, and we made a feature of them. And the aftermath was so much more tantalising to us than the event. You know, what happens after someone's told a bad joke that didn't go down well?
Right.
That's a bit of an awkward, you know, moment.
Extras was the series that you did after The Office, and you play Andy Millman, a film extra who desperately wants to get speaking lines in the films in which he appears. And as the series goes on, he succeeds in that quite wildly. But I want to play this early clip. This is one of my favorite moments from the series. He's an extra in a movie about a nun who hides Jews from Nazis during World War II. And your character, Andy, is dressed as a Nazi, and the movie's star, Kate Winslet, is in costume as a nun. And between scenes, they have this little chat.
I'd just like to say, I think, you know, you doing this is so commendable, you know, using your profile to keep the message alive about the Holocaust.
My God, I'm not doing it for that. I mean, I don't think we really need another film about the Holocaust, do we? It's like, how many have there been? You know, we get it. It was grim. Move on. No, I'm doing it because I've noticed that if you do a film about the Holocaust, guaranteed an Oscar. I've been nominated 4 times, never won. And the whole world is going, why hasn't Winslet won one?
Definitely, yeah.
That's it. That's why I'm doing it. Schindler's Bloody List. The Pianist. Oscars coming out of their arse.
You know, it's absolutely hilarious. And what makes it even funnier, of course, is that, you know, years
life
later...
Life imitated art.
Yeah,
exactly.
She won an Oscar for The Reader, and which was a Holocaust film. And we know, because you were on the Oscars as a presenter, what you said to her that night. What did she say to you?
She just laughed. She laughed. done a retrospective that's coming out in April in England about extras, and we've got all the stars to chat about their episode. And she says on there, Ricky Gervais thinks that Oscar's half his. It's not.
What do you think the percentage is?
I think about 50-50. She's about half it. She'd keep the Globe.
Well, you know, here was an idea, a really different idea for a television series, where you get to show pieces of these actual films, and therefore it's the perfect excuse to bring in guest stars. But the series is not about those movies at all. It's about your ambition and your friendships. And
I suppose it's I think people, you know, obviously the big names got the press heat. That, you know, that was, I think it was remarkable that we got Kate Winslet and Sam Jackson and Robert De Niro and David Bowie to pop up in a little sitcom. I mean, it was remarkable. But I think I'd rather do stuff that makes a big connection with a few people than a small connection with loads. I'd rather this be a few people's favourite show than, you know, millions and millions of people's 10th favourite show, because what's the point otherwise? And that's what I wanted to do. And also, even though the backdrop of it looks like it's media, it's not. Just like The Office wasn't really about selling paper, it was about a few people thrown together, you know, an arbitrary existence, walking the same carpet every day. Mm-hmm. And Extras wasn't really about filmmaking and film stars. It was about a group of friends trying to get on with different ambitions. It was important that we made them the bottom rung of the ladder, because no one wants to see, you know, unfeasibly handsome, brilliant people doing brilliant things. Where's the fun in that? Yeah. We want to see a struggle. We want to see people falling over, but getting themselves back up on their feet. And that's what's extraordinary. Ordinary people, their struggle. There's nothing as interesting as real life out your window. You walk down the street for half an hour, I'll give you half an hour of drama.
Religion is a continuing theme in your work, and especially the way that you espouse opinions through your characters about atheism. This is during an episode of Extras, the same one with Kate Winslet. And in this one, you have, you know, nuns and Nazis walking around in costume as extras. And Andy, your character, is talking with his best friend, a fellow movie extra played by Ashley Jensen. She's now on the TV series Ugly Betty here in the States. In this scene, she plays Maggie, a sweet but not very bright young woman, who tells Andy there's something about the movie they're filming that bothers her.
All these people going about pretending to be nuns.
What do you mean?
Do you think that's right?
It's a film.
I know, but they're all like wandering around as holy ladies. Wouldn't that offend God or something?
Offend God or someone?
But does it not worry you a bit?
No. What, offending God? I'm an atheist.
What one's that? Is that the one where you haven't decided what you want
to
do?
No, it's agnostic. I'm an atheist. I firmly believe there is no God.
Why?
What do you mean, what? The burden of proof's not on me. The burden of proof is on the people who say there is a God. I don't believe in God. I believe in science.
So do you not believe in anything like ghosts or spirits or anything?
No, I believe in ghosts or spirits or elves. It's certainly not God, no.
So what do you think happens when you die?
Well, if you're buried, you go in the ground and you're worm food.
See, I don't like that. I would rather believe that there is a God and your soul just floats away onto eternity and all your friends from school will be there, like all the ones you haven't seen for ages and all your dead pets and just like, oh, nice people. You don't have to worry about worms.
You believe in God, then?
Now, what are you thinking as you replay this?
I think that was a very sweet, funny clip that actually housed a very important point. It was someone who that was genuine, and her reasons for believing in God were that the alternative wasn't very nice. And I think that's a lot of people's reason for believing in God. That if there isn't a God, what's the point? Why are we here? Why are we born and we live this life of struggle and pain if there's nothing at the end of it? Well, I wish there was a God, but I can't believe in something that I don't. And I suppose that is personal in a sense, although it's not personal to talk about religion because of the effect it has on society as a whole.
I don't know what your own upbringing was. I know that you were one of four children, but I don't know if you grew up in a religious household, if you...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a very working class upbringing. My dad was a labourer, my mum was a housewife, and I don't know how much they believed, but I know for a working class mother, Jesus is like an unpaid babysitter. If she's not watching me, someone is. And also I think that, you know, the best you can hope for in a, you know, poor working class accommodations is not that your son becomes an international comedian, but that he doesn't die in a barroom fight
mm-hmm.
before he's clever enough to take, you know, care of himself. And that, you know, I think that if you're a God-fearing person and you live, you know, your life by Christian values, is a good rule of thumb, then you'll probably be okay. And so, you know, she did her best. And I believed in God till I was eight. And I remember I was doing some homework from the Bible, and my brother, who's a lot older than me, he was 11 years older than me, he was about 19, he came in and he just said, "Why do you believe in God?" And my mum went, "Bob." And I knew that
she had something to hide and he had something to tell me.
Now, watching television in the States right, you know, during the Olympics, it was unavoidable to see promos for Jerry Seinfeld's new series, The Marriage Ref. And at some point, you started getting promoted on that as a guest. Now, it looks like it's a panel show with comedy, and you're famously not married in real life, correct?
Yeah, I'm not. You'd say I wasn't married in the eyes of God.
Oh, no. Or in the eyes of a civil, yes.
Although, you know, I am with the same woman that we've lived together for 25 years. So I think we're probably more stable than most marriages.
Okay.
I think that's probably above average.
And my question
in terms of longevity.
Yeah, okay. And my question was not – I was not trying to question your personal relationship so much as to question your experience on The Marriage Ref. What was that like?
Yeah.
Who were you with?
Myself, Madonna, and Larry David. I mean,
there's
a dream
team. Oh,
what
was the green room like for that show?
Wow. It was the strangest show I've ever been on with us just giving – I mean, I can't imagine three more different opinions. And it was great to see how the panelists – interacted as well. At one point, Madonna has a go at Larry David, accused him of being a misogynist because he's always coming down on the side of the man. I mean, Madonna arguing with Larry David. Oh, well, I did lose it a few times. I was saying, this is weird. What am I doing here? I mean, look at this. What, Larry David, Madonna and Ricky Gervais giving people advice. I mean, is that the first point of call? That people are having trouble with their marriage. They go, well, call Madonna. Call Larry David. Call that fat bloke from England. But they do a good job. I don't think you'd have seen a panel show quite like it.
Well, panel shows as a TV critic is something that I miss, and that's a troika that I really would like to see on television.
I've never done them before. I've never do panel shows. But when Jerry Seinfeld calls you on your cell phone and says, "Hello, it's Jerry Seinfeld here. Do you want to do a show with Madonna and Larry David?" The answer's yes. The answer's yes. I'll never have that opportunity again.
When you do award shows, what's your opinion afterwards about how the people in those specific rooms react to what you're saying? What comes off better than you expected? What doesn't?
You know, I think you've got to assume that when you do comedy, if it's got any edge at all or is worth anything, that as many people are going to dislike it as like it. You know, you can't choose your sense of humour. It's like sexuality. You can't pretend to laugh at something you don't find funny. You know, it's very peculiar and very personal. So you can only do stuff that, you know, you find funny, and I hope it's entertaining. But with that, you know, there are caveats. I don't want to just go out there and do safe anodyne stuff that everyone will find mildly amusing, but, you know, they could do it themselves. Likewise, I don't want to go out there and bring the room down. I don't want to go out there. It was funny because the Mel Gibson gag, where I said, I like a drink as much as the next man, unless the next man is Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
There was one journalist in New York said, I noticed Mr. Gervais had a go at Mel Gibson's alcoholism, but failed to mention his anti-Semitism. Yeah, that would have been a nice half hour, wouldn't it? Yeah, let's talk about the Holocaust. And well done to Glee.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the forum for it. I wasn't giving anyone a hard time for their personal beliefs. I was having a laugh. I was ribbing the, you know, the people who are much more successful and famous and richer and more handsome than me. You know, but it was all done in good fun. I had no targets. I've got nothing against those people. But likewise, as I say, I don't want to go out there and make it very, very stuffy and safe and just anodyne. So you've got to do it for yourself. And I think I pitched it about right.
Ricky Gervais, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Ricky Gervais spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. Gervais's new HBO animated series, The Ricky Gervais Show, airs Fridays on HBO. It's adapted from his podcasts with Stephen Merchant and Carl Pilkington. You can learn about Carl Pilkington's theory of human reproduction in a clip from The Ricky Gervais Show on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
Tonight marks Jay Leno's return to The Tonight Show, but his image has been tarnished by a failed attempt at prime time and the train wreck it caused at NBC. Still, commentator Andrew Wallenstein says Leno doesn't deserve to be vilified, as he was on his own show in January by fellow late-night host Jimmy Kimmel.
You've got $800 million. For God's sakes, leave our shows alone.
Getting attacked on your own show is bad enough, considering Leno was already getting mocked by David Letterman.
They went to Jay, Big Jaw Leno, and they said, Jay, we're taking your show away from you.
Yes.
And Jay said, yeah, okay, well, that's pretty good.
But even as his rivals ribbed him mercilessly, Leno always kept his silence. Well, almost always.
Hey, Kev, you know the best way to get Letterman to ignore you?
What's that?
Marry him. Okay, that's the best way.
Now that Leno has returned to reclaim his late-night throne, one of the big questions is whether all the slings and arrows he sustained will diminish his audience. There's at least 50 Facebook groups dedicated to loathing him. So here's a simple question. Why the anti-Lenoism? Yes, it's sad that Conan O'Brien had The Tonight Show pulled out from under him and handed back to Leno. But why is that Leno's fault? There's not a shred of evidence Leno orchestrated this. But given the backlash against him, you'd think he owned NBC. Leno's sin is that he wins in the ratings. Attacking him is just a calculated way of trying to get some of that audience. There's a common perception that Leno is just a hack who peddles pablum. His success is offensive to those with refined palates, who prefer the allegedly hipper O'Brien. Now, let's say that Leno was shamelessly pandering. There's another word for that in the TV industry. It's called programming. People like it. It goes on the air. Why anyone would think broadcast television is intended to be a bastion of sophisticated humor is mystifying. That said, I don't think Leno is even guilty of any crimes against comedy. When it comes down to it, is anything Leno does really materially different than Letterman or O'Brien? I've never seen a meaningful distinction. So maybe it's time to cut Leno a break. And if you still don't like him, well, that's the beauty of TV. Just change the channel.
Andrew Wallenstein is an editor at The Hollywood Reporter. The end of this year's Olympics signals a time of important decisions. Olympic athletes leave Vancouver wondering what's next in their illustrious careers, and the millions who watch them are wondering, how are we going to fill the void? It happens every Olympics. Life revolves around the games, and then poof, they vanish. Apollo Ono, Lindsey Vonn, and the entire hockey team are no longer there. Well, NBC offered promo after promo for life after the Olympics.
Welcome to the marriage ref.
To solve the world's marriage problems,
we're going to give couples the one thing they've always wanted, a winner.
How did you make this happen?
Double scoop.
Triple.
Great parenting.
I'm crowning!
Yep, we're ready. The Office Baby is due Thursday after the Olympics on NBC.
Joining us to help Olympic couch potatoes through this trying time is Maureen Ryan, TV critic for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us by Skype. Maureen, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to. Thanks for having me.
And let's talk about some of those shows that we were just hearing promos for. The Marriage Ref. This is an idea sprung from the brain of Jerry Seinfeld, I guess, based on his own experience. How long do you think this is going to last?
I don't know. I actually saw some people on Twitter last night, some other critics and TV writers, wondering if maybe NBC would cancel it in progress, or maybe that was just wishful thinking on their part. I don't necessarily think that the concept was off, but the execution was very off. It was this, the concept is that couples have an argument about a particular subject, and then a celebrity panel judges their competing arguments and decides who's right.
And the judges, I think, are including, what, Madonna, Kelly Ripa,
right.
Jerry Seinfeld himself.
Various, yeah. And one of the things that was off-putting is that they thought they were hilarious. I did not think it was hilarious. And also, it just, the whole execution of the thing was just not particularly funny and actually made me feel sad. And when it finally has its premiere in its regular time slot on Thursday, I'm just wondering if it's going to make people nostalgic for Jay Leno in prime time.
Hmm. So not too optimistic about The Marriage Ref. What about other new shows that you think have more promise?
Well, another NBC show that they are putting into the lineup as of Tuesday is Parenthood, which is, they're trying to reboot this film, and then it was a TV series for a while some time ago, and now they're trying to do another TV show based on the film Parenthood. It has a good cast. I think some elements work better than others. I think Lauren Graham from Gilmore Girls is outstanding. But there's some really cool new offerings that I definitely would want to mention. And I think in terms of things that are getting me excited about the post-Olympic time frame in TV, the two shows I'm most excited about are Justified, a new program on FX, which premieres March 16th, and it stars Timothy Oliphant as a lawman in Kentucky. And it's really, really good. It really is tremendous dialogue, great performances, a lot of great just elements cohere in this show right from the beginning. I highly recommend it. And then there's also The Pacific on HBO as of March 14th. And that, if you saw Band of Brothers and you loved it, you absolutely cannot miss The Pacific. It's an incredibly made saga of Marines fighting World War II in the Pacific. And it's one of the most well-done productions I've ever seen on TV. It's just, it's absolutely well-acted, well-performed. And just the stories that it presents are not only exciting, but they're also kind of heartbreaking in terms of watching these guys fight this very, very difficult war.
Maureen, I've also been wondering how long our national nightmare will have to continue. How long will we have to wait for Glee to come back on Fox?
Thank you. You're speaking my language. we're on the same page here. It's not coming back till April 13th, and you can get ready for a whole bunch of new Glee episodes, including one directed by cult favorite Joss Whedon. Neil Patrick Harris is going to be in an episode. They're just going crazy when the show comes back. And on top of that, the show's going to go on a four-city tour in May. It's going to swing through Chicago, Phoenix, LA, and New York. So you could catch a live stage show with the cast if you want to as well, if you're that much of a Glee fanatic.
I wouldn't confess if I were. Yes, I would.
Of course not.
Maureen Ryan, TV critic for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks very much.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
We've been looking over the images of a video war game. You see the world as it looks to a soldier. You walk through the streets of a bomb-blasted town. And around the corner, you spot an enemy.
Enemy spotted.
Medic! Enemy down!
The game is called America's Army. Millions of people play.
Follow me.
And the developer is the United States military. The game caught the interest of Peter Singer. He wrote in Foreign Policy magazine of the way that real and virtual war have merged.
Once you're physically in the game, it's what they call a first-person shooter.
First-person shooter meaning you're looking at the world through your gun sight.
Enemy spotted.
America's Army started as a military recruiting tool, and parts of the game show what military training is like. Yet Peter Singer says the game's popularity has gone far beyond its original intent.
This game has been one of the top 10 games downloaded off the internet of all games. It's hugely popular, not just in the U.S., but even in places like China. The Chinese government tried to ban it. But more important to that, in terms of the Army really didn't care about its popularity, is did it help with recruiting or not? And one study found that the game had more impact on actual recruits than all other forms of Army advertising combined.
Why do you suppose that this game became a success beyond its value apparently as a recruiting tool?
It's actually a pretty good game. You know, it's got good packages, good graphics, etc., compelling stories. The interesting thing, though, is that this game is just the start of a broader spectrum of something that I call militainment, where the military is drawing from entertainment for its tools. That is everything from tools of recruiting, like in America's Army, to the tools of entertainment in terms of actually using the weapon systems. Many of the controllers for robotic systems on both ground and air, things like the Predator.
The drones that are over Pakistan and Afghanistan, for example.
Exactly, but also things like the PackBot, which is a little tiny ground robot. They're actually modeled after the Xbox and PlayStation controllers. And the reason was the military found is these video game companies had spent tens of millions of dollars designing systems that fit in your hand perfectly. But more importantly, the training costs had already been taken out because you hand these to an 18-year-old and they automatically know how to use it.
Are these virtual games in some ways more valuable than real-world training because you can build up an intricate and life-threatening situation on the screen that might be hard to duplicate in real life?
It's an interesting question, and it's something that the military is wrestling with right now. The advocates of the game say things like you can build more complexity in than you could in a regular training program out in the field. More importantly, you can run through it again and again and again in a way that you can in real-world training, but of course, there's other aspects that go into real-world training that maybe you do need in there. And one of those that I think is a concern is that the video games often forget about what we call the fog of war. So, for example, there's one package that recaptures what happened in a real-world battle during the invasion of Iraq where a Green Beret team fought off a Iraqi battalion that had tanks and the like. And so in the game, you can do the same thing that the Green Berets did. What the game leaves out, though, is that when the Green Berets called in an airstrike, the airstrike accidentally hit some of their own and also killed some of our Kurdish allies. The unexpected is often hard for us to program in.
There are any number of writers on military affairs who have raised concerns about this sort of thing because you make war antiseptic, you make it virtual, you make it clean for the shooter, but in the end, on the other end, there may well be a dead person.
And that's what some have jokingly called avatar fatigue, that if you mess up, if you lose, so to speak, in the game, you just reboot. You've lost your avatar. Whereas if you lose in reality, you actually have to call your buddy's wife and explain what happened. A bigger concern within the military is what's called the O'Brien effect, taken from an incident where the talk show host Conan O'Brien challenged Serena Williams, the tennis player, to a tennis match. She came out and he handed her a Nintendo Wii and he proceeded to beat her. And the point here was that just because you excel in the video game of something, it doesn't mean that you excel in the real world version of something.
Peter Singer wrote an article in Foreign Policy magazine called Meet the Sims and Shoot Them. Thanks very much.
Thank you.